Comics. Comics. Welcome to another episode of ORP, the flagship show of Omen Comics Podcast Network. I am your host, Michael Nunley, and with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Steve Sellers. Today, we're going to do the first of a two-episode deep dive into the Fantastic Four from Marvel Comics. In this episode, we'll cover the creation process and the comics themselves. And next week, you'll get part two, where we'll cover the films and, of course, the various animated series. Now, I'm a big fan of the Fantastic Four, and I have been for some time, but I know my man Steve here is a way bigger Fantastic Four fan than I am. So I'm guessing he has a few words to say before we get started. Am I right, Steve?
That's a pretty good guess, Mike. The Fantastic Four is a team that I have a lot of history with, almost since I started reading Marvel Comics. The X-Men were my first love at Marvel, but the FF is fairly close behind. I actually started reading around Secret Wars, which introduced me to Doom. And then I ended up reading the John Byrne FF run and the Thing solo book around that point. So I've read a pretty large chunk of FF comics since then, and I'm familiar with many of the major runs on the book. The book just offers a great balance between family dynamics, high adventure, pulp science fiction, and classic superheroics. At its best, the FF earns its title of the world's greatest comics magazine. So this is an episode I'm looking forward to diving into. But with that preamble out of the way, why don't you get us started, Mike?
I'd be happy to, Steve. Well, I don't have the comics experience that you do. I have watched every available documentary on comics that I can find, and they have covered the gold through the bronze ages of comics, and that's really where I'm coming from here as far as what information I know about. In fact, watching those documentaries is where I acquired my hatred for Frederick Wortham that we've talked about a time or two. But on to the creation of the FF. There's a legend about where the idea to make a team of superheroes over at Marvel Comics came from that has been circulating for quite a while. I have heard the story myself several times, mostly in those documentaries. But anyway, it goes like this. In 1961, Marvel Comics publisher Martin Goodman was playing golf with the owner of National Periodical Publications that would become DC Comics 16 years later. As the legend does not specify which owner of National Periodical Publications, all I can say is that it was either Jack Liebowitz or Irwin Donnefeld, as they were the co-owners. Anyway, one of the co-owners of National Periodical Publications was bragging about the success of their new superhero team, the Justice League of America, that had first appeared in The Brave and the Bold, number 28, in March of 1960, but was so popular that it had gotten its own title by November of that same year. And by golfing season in March of 1961, Justice League of America was in its third issue. That is one version of the story, anyway. The other version of the story cites the same Justice League of America title, but there is no golf game. In this story, Marvel Comics publisher Martin Goodman was known for following the latest trends and knew how well the Justice League of America title was doing. So he directed his editor, Stan Lee, to create a series about a team of superheroes for Marvel. I personally want to lean towards the second version of that story, but that's just me. Do you have a preference there, Steve?
You know, that's a good question. I personally seem to recall Stan favoring the second version of the story, that he was told to come up with a superhero team to compete with the Justice League of America title. And eventually Stan would come up with that kind of concept when he co-created the Avengers. But he had another idea that he wanted to get off the ground first, and one that it was the book that he really wanted to do. Mike, did you want to get into what Stan had in mind?
I sure do, Steve. What Martin Goodman didn't know, what nobody really knew besides Stan Lee and his wife Joan, was that Stan was seriously considering quitting. He had been both editor-in-chief and the art director of Marvel and its predecessor companies, Timely Comics and Atlee Comics, for two decades, and felt like the genre had grown stagnant and creatively restrictive. So when Stan Lee was asked to do a superhero team title, he went home to talk to his wife Joan about it. He told her that he wanted to write a story the way he wanted to write it, not like all the generically formulaic stories that had become the norm. Joan said that is exactly what he should do then. If he was going to quit anyway, what difference would it make if they fired him for doing it? Stan had to agree. So just this once, Stan Lee wrote Fantastic Four to be the type of story that he himself would enjoy reading, with flawed, flesh-and-blood characters he could relate to. In Stan Lee's words, they'd be fallible and feisty, and most important of all, inside their colorful costume booties, they'd still have feet of clay, which is an obvious reference to the figure seen in Nebuchadnezzar's dream that collapsed after the stone struck its feet mixed with clay and iron. Having superheroes with such faults and foibles was a novel idea at the time, and Fantastic Four, cover dated November 1961, was when Marvel entered the Silver Age of comics, which had begun 5 years prior in March of 1956 in DC Showcase number 4 featuring the new Flash, Barry Allen.
The Fantastic Four was the book that ushered in the Marvel Age of comics, because this was the one book that started the approach that Stan really wanted to take. Certainly there was the flavor of Silver Age comics up to that point with science-based heroes and so forth. But what Stan brought was the humanity of superheroes, and the FF was the start of that. So by making the FF a family with the complex relationships that families often have, he hit just the right notes and he struck them hot. But he was also hedging his bets a little by including the Thing, someone who would feel at home just as much in a 60s Marvel monster book as he was in the FF. That was by design, just in case the FF didn't work out as planned. Stan and Jack knew what they were doing, but I think that there were questions about that you wanted to address, Mike?
There is, Steve. There is some debate about who actually came up with the Fantastic Four. In a 1968 fanzine interview, Stan Lee said that both he and Jack the King Kirby created the Fantastic Four. Jack Kirby created the characters visually, but the conception of the characters was mostly him. In Origins of Marvel Comics in 1974, Stan Lee elaborated a bit more on the process, saying that he had developed the basic characters and the story synopsis for the first issue for penciler Jack Kirby to follow. But both Jack Kirby and publisher Martin Goodman were involved in the creative process before that synopsis was written. Listen to this in Stan's own words. After kicking around with Martin and Jack for a while, I decided to call our quaint quartet the Fantastic Four. I wrote a detailed first synopsis for Jack to follow, and the rest is history. Kirby turned in his penciled pages to Lee, who adapted the dialogue and captions. This approach to creating comics, which became known as the Marvel Method, worked so well that Lee and Kirby used it from then on, and the Marvel Method became the standard for the company within a year. You know, at Omen Comics, I decided a long time ago that we were never even going to go anywhere near the Bob Kane, Bill Finger disaster. And we always credit our artist, Tosin Awasika, as a co-creator because he is the visual creator. But it sounds like the Marvel Method is actually much more involved with the co-creating process, with Martin Goodman even adding input. I mean, that's a whole other ball of wax.
It is sadly true that Jack Kirby got the short end of the stick when it came to his creations. I mean, he was hugely imaginative, and he created a ton of great characters for both companies. A number of them he created pretty much himself. The Silver Surfer, for instance, was pure Kirby, and Stan didn't even know who he was until he saw Kirby's art for him. But Kirby also created the Eternals, Darkseid, the New Gods, Kamandi, and others by himself. So I have no doubt that Kirby contributed a ton to the FF and their mythos, especially when we talk about later characters like Galactus, the Surfer, and the Black Panther. While I think Bill Finger holds the crown for creators who have been screwed over by the comics industry, Kirby is up there as well. In fact, he was sometimes quoted as saying, "Comics will break your heart, kid," referring to the way that creators were often treated by the mainstream comics industry. Now, things did eventually improve, especially with the Image Revolution and the rise of creator-owned indie comics. But even in recent years, you get some shoddy treatment of older creators at the hand of the big two. I mean, just ask Mike Friedrich when talking about Marvel Comics. It's just sad that it took people like Kirby to getting a raw deal before creators' rights really became a thing in comics.
Before they became a thing in comics. I see what you did there. But speaking of Jack Kirby's part of the process, what I have said thus far has only been Stan's side of the story. In 1970, 2 years after Stan Lee's interview in Fanzine, Jack Kirby got an interview in that same publication. In that interview, Jack Kirby did say that Stan Lee was involved in the creation of the Fantastic Four, but said that the main characters and ideas were his. In Kirby's words, "It was my idea. It was my idea to do it the way it was. My idea to develop it the way it was." I'm not saying that Stan had nothing to do with it. Of course he did. We talked things out. However, 20 years later, while being interviewed by Gary Roth, Kirby was directly confronted with Stan Lee's version of what happened, and Jack Kirby said, "I would say that's an outright lie." Kirby claims that he came up with the idea for the Fantastic Four in Marvel's offices and that Stan Lee merely added in the dialogue after the story was penciled. Kirby also sought to establish that the visual elements of the script were his conceptions. He regularly pointed to the team he created for rival publisher DC Comics in the 1950s, the Challengers of the Unknown. If you notice the uniforms, they're the same. I always give them a skin-tight uniform with a belt. The Challengers and the FF have a minimum of decoration, and of course, the Thing's skin is a kind of decoration, breaking up the monotony of the blue uniform. It is important to note, however, that the Fantastic Four wore civilian garb instead of their uniforms, which were only introduced along with the Baxter Building headquarters in the third issue of the series following readership feedback. The original submitted design was also modified to include the iconic chest insignia of a four within a circle that was designed by Lee.
To be honest, the Fantastic Four was not exactly a new concept in any case. It was a reinvention of a pulp science fiction series called Skylark, which was created by E.E. Doc Smith, best known for the Lensman series, which inspired Green Lantern. Both Stan and Jack were familiar with science fiction pulps, and they probably decided to do their own version of it. Let me make the case for why I think this, and then we'll get into Lee and Kirby's differences of opinion. Skylark centers around a man named Richard Seaton, a scientist that discovers an X element that enables faster than light travel. Seaton then enlists his girlfriend, his best friend, and one other as part of the crew to explore space. Seaton's rival, a criminal scientist named Mark Duquesne, discovers Seaton's plan and then tries to stop him, only to be disfigured in the attempt. Eventually, after a series of adventures, Duquesne takes over an entire corporation and then makes himself essentially a god, and the Skylark crew has to stop him. I am greatly oversimplifying the series, but there are so many similarities between Skylark and the FF and Dr. Doom that I have to conclude they're likely intentional. I'll also add that Doc Savage was probably an influence too. The adversarial relationship between Ben and Johnny mirrors Monk and Ham, who were two of Doc's assistants. You also get elements like the FF operating out of a skyscraper, which Doc Savage and his band of iron did as well. Reed and Doc are both the smartest men of their respective worlds and they're renowned inventors. Also, Doc even had his own Dr. Doom in the form of John Sunlight, who is the only Doc villain to appear twice in the pulps. So I think Lee and Kirby took bits and pieces of old pulps that they both enjoyed and mashed them together. What I think likely happened is that Lee and Kirby probably wanted to do a book in that vein with more of a Silver Age superhero flair. They were modernizing a decades-old concept and making something new from it. Kirby did very likely borrow from this Challenger designs. I think that that definitely makes sense. Kirby also very much was into rough and tumble adventurers, so bringing some of that all in also seems likely. Lee also brought his feet of clay approach, emphasizing the family elements and the personal drama, while Kirby brought the high adventure and the cosmic scale. So I think there was a real collaboration there, even if Lee and Kirby may have disagreed on the particulars of who did what. And if I may add, I think the name Fantastic Four definitely sounds like the kind of bombastic name that Stan Lee would come up with.
Oh, definitely, definitely. He's Stan Lee is known for giving names to things with the exact same letters starting both names. So that totally fits. I totally believe that. I did not know about those old pulp connections, though. Out of all the docs I have watched, and there have been many, that has never come up, but I have to wonder why. As you described it, that really seems to be a very obvious influence on the FF. But let's get to what evidence is available and what others have to say about it. A tight synopsis by Stan Lee for the introductory segment of the first Fantastic Four issue exists and outlines the characters and their origins with various minor differences to the published version. However, Earl Wells, writing out of the Comics Journal, points out that its existence does not assert its place in the creation. He says, "We have no way of knowing whether Lee wrote the synopsis after a discussion with Kirby, in which Kirby supplied most of the ideas." Earl Wells went on to say that Lee's contribution set the framework within which Kirby worked, and this made Lee more responsible. Wells argues that comic historian Mark Evanier, a studio assistant to Jack Kirby in the 1970s, says that the considered opinion of Lee and Kirby's contemporaries was that the Fantastic Four was created by Stan and Jack. No further division of credit seemed to be appropriate. But comics historian R.C. Harvey believes the Fantastic Four was a continuation of the work Kirby previously did, and so more likely Kirby's creation than Lee's. However, he did say that the Marvel method of collaboration allowed each man to claim credit, and Lee's dialogue added to the direction the team took.
It's really hard to say, and I don't think we're ever going to know for sure what the real division of labor was. Did Kirby do more than has been admitted to by Stan? It seems like that's possible, maybe even likely. But I too am ready to go with Lee and Kirby when talking about the FF. Because really, I think that the Stan and Jack collaboration was one where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It took Stan to find the humanity and the heart in the brilliant ideas that Jack brought to the table. It took Jack's imagination and visual storytelling magic to bring Stan's words to life in an eye-catching way. It took both of them for that run on Fantastic Four to be as groundbreaking and legendary as it was.
I can agree with that. But it seems like both men are leaving out Martin Goodman's involvement. At least what I assume was his involvement. As I mentioned earlier, he was in on the initial creation discussion with Lee and Kirby, and he was known for following popular entertainment trends in order to bring more sales to Marvel books. Well, you'll note that in 1959, Henry Levin's Journey to the Center of the Earth hit theaters. Consider that that film, as I described rather generically what happens in Fantastic Four number one. You get a team of four adventurers, three men and a woman, led by a professor, traveling to the Earth Center and encountering giant monsters while contending with a human protagonist who is also from the surface world.
That's a good catch, and it might well have been on Stan and Jack's mind as well, along with Skylark and Doc Savage. The B-movies of the 50s gave rise to the Marvel monster books, and both Stan and Martin Goodman were no stranger to taking advantage of trends that work. They may not have been quite as bad as Chris Claremont in that respect, but Stan had a good sense of where the winds were blowing, and he knew which way to turn in response, so that's certainly an additional possibility.
I just know that Journey to the Center of the Earth was an awesome movie, and I also know that Goodman was on the ground floor discussion on the FF, and his contributions are never brought up by Stan or Jack, so I had to throw something out there that seemed to fit, but it is just speculation. One thing that seems to have been from Lee and Kirby, maybe even Martin Goodman, as they all three of them are Jewish, is that Benjamin Jacob Grimm is Jewish. Jacob is the name of the father of the Jewish people, and Benjamin is one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Jack Kirby even featured the thing in his Hanukkah card, which I thought was cool. The thing also resembles the golem from Jewish folklore, who acted as a protector to the Jews, with the exception that golems are formed out of clay. I don't think that was an accident, but rather a direct inspiration for Kirby, who created how the thing looked. But even golems being made out of clay is minor, as the powers of all the Fantastic Four are based on one of the four classical elements of air with the Invisible Woman, fire with the Human Torch, and water with Mr. Fantastic, and of course, Ben's element was earth.
Right, and Ben was always the character who was most associated with Jack Kirby. Kirby was the rough and tumble guy from a rough neighborhood like Ben, and he'd been in his share of fights. This is likely one of the reasons that his action sequences are so good. Also, I'm inclined to think that the Jacob in Ben's name was indeed a nod to Jack Kirby, whose real name was Jacob Kurtzberg. If Kirby had an avatar in the Marvel Universe, it was clearly Ben Grimm, the man of stone with a heart of gold.
I have to say that I like that, and it makes me like the thing even more. But when it comes to the FF, I honestly don't know who was the main creator of the Fantastic Four, and being that there is no official documentation to prove beyond a reasonable doubt either way, and both men are dead, I don't know that we will ever know exactly what happened, as I think you just had to be there. You know, several people can view the same event and describe it a different way, and I tend to think that's what happened here. Either way, the success of Fantastic Four number one convinced Stan Lee to stay on making comics. Fantastic Four started receiving fan mail, and Stan Lee started printing the letters in a letter column with issue number three. Also with the third issue, Lee created the hyperbolic slogan, "The Greatest Comic Magazine in the World." But with the following issue, the slogan was changed to "The World's Greatest Comic Magazine," which sounds a lot better. And that became the fixture on issues covers clear into the 1990s and on numerous covers in the 2000s. But now I'm starting to tread into my friend Steve's territory, talking about the comics themselves. So why don't you take it from here, Steve?
Sure, I'd be glad to. But to address your points on authorship and who created what, there's no way we're ever going to hash this out definitively without a time machine. It's clear that both Stan and Jack played a strong role in the development of the Fantastic Four, even if the exact credit is hard to pin down. For now, though, let's talk about what exactly they did in the book. Before I get into my coverage, keep in mind that this is not going to be comprehensive, and I'm not going to get into every single run, or we're going to be here all day. A lot of them are just not that noteworthy, especially the ones between Stan and Jack and the John Byrne era. There are the great FF runs, and then there are the runs that tread water. I mean, a lot of them do perfectly fine, but they aren't the most memorable. I've even had a few leave out runs that I like but aren't that impactful, or otherwise we would be here for a while. I also won't be covering the most recent runs like the Stan Slott run, so this is very much going to be coverage of the high points. With that out of the way, let's start from the beginning. A lot of people, especially creators, will say that Stan and Jack not only created the FF, they also gave us the definitive run on the book. I'm not quite ready to go that far, but it is easily among the greatest runs on the title. I think the reason people tend to credit Lee and Kirby as much as they do is because of the sheer volume of inventiveness and creativity. In 104 issues, Lee and Kirby introduced such things as the Mole Man, Dr. Doom, the Mad Thinker, the Inhumans, the Black Panther, the Silver Surfer, Galactus, the Skrulls, Annihilus, and other characters and ideas that became cornerstones of not just the FF mythos, but the Marvel Universe at large. They also brought back Namor the Submariner in a big way, taking a classic Golden Age character and making him a complex antagonist and eventually into an ally of the team. I don't think there's any question that Lee and Kirby dominate all other FF creators in terms of what they brought to the Fantastic Four. At the same time, I also feel like the Lee Kirby run is where we start to see real change and growth in the characters. Reed and Sue grow together over the course of their adventures, eventually marrying and starting a family together. Their son Franklin was born late into the run in a story involving Annihilus. That was huge, and it hadn't been done before in comics as far as I can recall. Powers would grow and develop. Ben would go from lumpy and clay-like and into orange rock. Sue would develop the ability to create invisible force fields, which was the key to her eventually becoming one of the most powerful members of the team. Johnny actually did show quite a bit of character growth back then as well, especially when Crystal and the Inhumans became a part of his life.
I have to ask a quick side question here real quick. What the heck did Annihilus have to do with the birth of Franklin?
It was a story involving the Negative Zone, and I want to say he was captured or something like that. I can't remember exactly what happened. It was in an annual.
Okay.
Yeah.
It sounded almost like Annihilus had something to do with maybe Franklin's conception or something somehow in that story. And that might explain some of his powers or something. That's where I was going with that. But
no, I don't think so. I think it was more that, you know, Sue had always had problems, you know, with when it came to childbirth, and I think it was something to do with that, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
I see. Okay. I do find it interesting that the thing started out as a lumpy clay-like creature, considering that he was most likely based on the golem from both the Bible and Jewish mysticism, which was made out of clay but could grow stronger and more powerful over time. It seems to me like Ben went on a similar journey, but back to the Lee and Kirby run.
That does make sense now that you mention it. I have no idea if it was a deliberate influence, but I could definitely see Stan or Jack coming up with that idea. But yes, let's move on. I honestly don't want to recap the entire Lee Kirby run because that would take more time than we have. And some of those stories end up being adapted into the 90s FF cartoon anyway. So we'll talk about specific stories when we get to part two. But you did have stories that were small, personal, and impactful alongside sweeping cosmic epics. This man, this monster, is probably my favorite of the small stories, dealing with Ben Grimm as he overcomes an imposter who takes his powers. I don't want to spoil this one, as you really need to read this for yourself. The ending is surprising and emotionally powerful, and it hits Ben on a deep level. But I will say that it's a story a lot of people point to as a great example of a single issue done in one comic story. I'll also add that Kirby's art is moody and just perfectly tailored for the dramatic in that one. But you also had great vistas like the Negative Zone and stories like the Galactus arc that go truly into the cosmic scale. You also get everything in between, including adventures in exotic locales like Wakanda and Atlantis, as well as superheroes in New York City. Lee and Kirby brought all that to life in a way that built excitement and really made everything pop on the page. It was a run where just about any kind of crazy thing could happen. Any bizarre new characters could show up. And there was a strong sense of wonder about it all. But grounding that were these four characters who had a perfectly balanced team dynamic that no lineup since has been able to duplicate. And believe me, they have tried. Now, are there problems with this run? Sure. Some elements of the book just don't age that well, unfortunately, mainly some of Stan's dialogue and characterization choices. there's a very 1960s depiction when it comes to characters like Sue, and then Reed and says and does things that aren't very flattering in a modern light. It was a 1960s comic for good or ill. And not every character idea lands that well either. I mean, you get silly characters like the Infant Terrible or the Impossible Man from time to time. Some characters like him, who would be, later become Adam Warlock, were fleshed out much better by later writers. But by the standards of Silver Age comics, it was a landmark run that shaped the way that comics were made ever since then.
I have to say that basically most of what I know from about the Fantastic Four seems to have come directly from Lee and Kirby. What's more is that Lee and Kirby are the folks who made the FF the first family of Marvel. Not just because Lee and Kirby developed the Marvel method creating the FF, and not just because the FF launched Marvel into the Silver Age, but because the Fantastic Four was the first superhero comic that began developing long-term story arcs for the characters, both heroes and villains alike. And that those story arcs would span multiple issues to go through. The continuity started in the FF would eventually grow to encompass the whole of the Marvel Universe and in a way make the FF the literal first family of Marvel. But there was something equally monumental about the Fantastic Four. It was written with a more adult audience in mind. It assumed a certain level of intelligence on the part of the reader and did not pander to children. I don't think the comics were out of reach for the younger audience. I'm not saying that. But unlike the comics, the FF was not written specifically for children, and that made a huge difference. In fact, Fantastic Four number one was extremely popular among college students of the day, just to give you an idea of who was reading them. I would go as far as to say that superheroes as we know them today would not be as popular as they are without the Fantastic Four, specifically, but not limited to issue number one. But let's get back into the comic runs.
The early Marvel comics managed to do well at being family-friendly while challenging the reader. This is true. Stan and Jack definitely set the tone for that. But let's get into what happened after the run ended. Mind that this is a whopping run of 104 issues by one creative team, a record that stood for decades until Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley broke it with Ultimate Spider-Man. So even the end of the run was a huge achievement. Most of what happened between the Lee and Kirby run and the second major run is not hugely memorable. A lot of writers just generally try to follow in the footsteps of Stan and Jack, and what you got was generally serviceable stories that didn't really capture the imagination nearly as well as they did. You can skip over many of those runs and not feel like you missed too much. That said, there is one exception I want to talk about, and that is one of my favorite overlooked Dr. Doom stories. After Jack Kirby left the FF, Stan remained on as writer for a little while afterwards. He was joined by John Buscema, an industry legend who is best known for books like Avengers and Conan. Those stories likewise didn't have the power of the Kirby issues, even with Stan involved and a titan like Buscema on the art. With the help of incoming writer Archie Goodwin, Stan did have one last banger of a story left, and that is the Overmind arc. The premise of that story is that the Overmind is an alien who has come to Earth to conquer it in the name of a group called the Eternals of Eung. Overmind is the chosen one of an ancient prophecy. From beyond the stars shall come the Overmind, and he shall crush the universe. The Overmind initially lives up to that promise because he defeats the Thing with relative ease, and then he goes on to take down the entire Four by himself. He even manages to use his psychic powers to take over Reed's mind. The situation is so bad, in fact, that Sue decides to run, realizing that the only person who might be able to help is none other than Victor Von Doom. Sue appeals to Doom's sense of honor, and he agrees, giving his word to his sister, though I suspect what motivates Doom to agree is his ego and his refusal to leave Reed Richards' death to anyone but him, as well as the fact that the Overmind is a threat to his power. But Doom is true to his word, and the fight between Doom and the Overmind is awesome. Doom has devised a plan to use the FF's powers and his own technology against the Overmind, and it works for a while. Doom builds a device called a psionic refractor that turns Overmind's power against him, protecting Doom and weakening the Overmind at the same time. After a protracted battle, Overmind manages to destroy the psionic refractor, and Doom is still able to resist his power with sheer will alone. While Doom and the FF still don't quite win the battle, the power unleashed attracts the attention of a cosmic being called the Stranger, who ultimately stops the Overmind. But the reason I love this story is because this is the first story where we see Doom's relationship with the team become more complex than simply being arch enemies. Doom is willing to hear Sue out, and he respects her enough to give her his word, something Doom never gives lightly. And on top of that, he keeps his word to her, even protecting people like Ben that he despises, because defeating the Overmind matters more to him than his feud with the FF. He also leads the team successfully, and though they fail, it is not because of anything Doom does. He planned ahead, and he uses the FF's ability to great effect. In the words of Jean-Luc Picard, it's possible to commit no errors and still lose. Doom made absolutely no mistakes in his plan, and it very nearly works. He's just up against a ludicrously powerful opponent. On top of that, Doom goes down like a total badass, resisting the Overmind with every ounce of his will, and he is the last one standing in the fight with the Overmind. The Overmind tends to be a bit overlooked compared to some classic Doom stories, but it is one of the greats.
I just loved that prophecy, and you did the impression actually pretty well. I mean, just took me right back to Saturday morning with the Marvel Hour. I loved it. But after hearing that, I not only think I have a better idea of why you are a Dr. Doom fan, but I think I'm actually turning into a bigger fan myself. That sounds like a great story that really speaks a lot about his character. In fact, I would go as far as to say that Dr. Doom is the more interesting part of that story. But let's get back into the next run you wanted to talk about, Steve.
Yes, sounds good. The second truly great run on the Fantastic Four happened when John Byrne took over the title as writer and artist. Now, keep in mind that this is technically Byrne's second run on the book. He did some issues as an artist prior to that. I'll talk very briefly about that period. Byrne got involved with the FF at the tail end of a run written by Marv Wolfman, who is best known for Blade and the new Teen Titans. While getting into it will take us too much off track, I will say that you should read it if you're a Nova fan. It's great. Probably the best Byrne illustrated issue, though, was the last part of that story where a cosmic villain called the Sphinx confronts Galactus. Even then, Byrne knew how to give the Big G an immense sense of scale and dramatic weight. But let's move on to Byrne's second stint on the FF, where he becomes legendary. Flash forward a few years later, where Byrne has just left the X-Men, and in my view at least, he's at the height of his artistic powers. He goes off and takes over the Fantastic Four. He starts off with a pretty simple Diablo story, and it's pretty decent as Diablo stories go, which is usually not very good. But then he goes on and does some crazy things like Terror in a Tiny Town, where Doom projects the minds of the FF into miniatures that are trapped in a scale model city of Doom's design. The story is actually better than I make it sound, and it sets the tone for how good Doom is in this run. In fact, I would put John Byrne among the very best creators that Victor Von Doom has ever had, as writer or artist. From here, though, I'll hit some of the highlights of the Byrne run. The Fantastic Four fight Gladiator, the Praetor of the Shi'ar Imperial Guard. This is basically Byrne's take on Superman versus the Fantastic Four, and it is some good fun. The cover where Gladiator stands over the beaten FF has been homaged a few times, even by Byrne himself when he worked on Superman. That leads into Byrne's big Galactus arc, where Galactus again tries to consume the Earth. The Fantastic Four, along with all of the major Earth heroes, team up to stop Galactus, and you get some great action pieces in that arc. The real selling point is the ending, where Reed saves Galactus's life, and then Galactus promises to spare the Earth. That changes their entire relationship moving forward, and it also sets up the trial of Galactus, which is awesome. But let's move on to one of my personal favorites, This Land Is Mine, where Dr. Doom reconquers Latveria with the help of the Fantastic Four. Doom gets briefly deposed by Zorba, who was the last survivor of the previous Latverian royal dynasty, and now Victor wants his country back. Zorba proves to be a far worse ruler than Doom ever was, and the story shows us why the Latverians tend to prefer Doom as their king. It also expands on the complexity of Doom that we saw in the Overmind arc, how Doom's sense of honor leads him to occasionally doing the right thing, despite his ruthlessness, pride, and ambition. We also see here why Doom adopts the boy Christoph Vernard as his son. Christoph's mother was a Romani under Doom's protection. She was part of his tribe, and she is murdered by Zorba's minions. This moment angers Doom, showing some humanity under the armor. And when Doom gets his vengeance on Zorba, it is so satisfying. This is a story that does a good job of making you root for Doom, even though he's the arch villain. And it is one of my favorite Doom stories to this day. I also enjoyed the follow-up to this, where Doom takes off in the FF again and ultimately gets in a huge battle with Terax, who is another of Galactus's heralds.
Damn, I'm... I know a little bit about how Doom ruled Latveria, and I'm just trying to picture Zorro must have been a serious piece of work that Dr. Doom was the preferred leader.
I mean, Doom provided for him. He genuinely cares for his subjects. It's just his idea of caring for his subjects includes, you know, very dictatorial fascist tactics.
Right. Again, I have to say, I am loving Doom a bit more with each story you elaborate on. I always saw him as a villain whose only pursuits are vengeance on Reed and more power. And oftentimes he doesn't even know what to do with it by power once he has it. But I am learning the error of my assumptions here. There is a lot more to Doom than I thought. I think I might need to pick up that book of Doom Omnibus.
I think you absolutely should, because it hits a good cross-section of what makes Doom a cool villain. It also includes stories outside the purview of our FF discussion, like Doom's odd couple friendship with Namor and supervillain team-up. It also includes Triumph and Torment, which is another of the all-time great Doom stories. But let's get Return to the FF for now. Now, I'll lead into the Trial of Galactus, which is generally considered the high point of Byrne's FF. Basically, the Shi'ar get word that Reed Richards spared Galactus, and the interstellar community places Reed Richards on trial for having done this. What makes the story so fascinating is that Byrne uses the trial setting to evaluate what Galactus is as a cosmic force in the universe. The story establishes that Galactus is more than just a cosmic predator. Galactus is a force of nature, and he fulfills an important balance against Death and Eternity, who's the embodiment of all life. There's some good philosophical questioning in this one, and I think you might appreciate that aspect of it, Mike.
That Reed saves Galactus' life in the comics is interesting. As someone more familiar with the on-screen version of the FF, I can't help but think of When Galactus Calls from the 1994 animated series where Reed Richards saves Galactus. I'll be honest, and I'll say that I always thought that was a little off, and that they barely touch on the stuff you mentioned there in the episode, so it never really made sense to me. But when you talk about Galactus fulfilling a universal balance between life and death so that neither aspect takes more than it should, that does interest me quite a bit. You know, destruction is in fact part of the circle of life as new life comes from it. As an immediate example, I think of forest fires that destroy and lay waste to vast tracts of land. And yet, without periodic forest fires, the ground would not be exposed to sunlight, which stimulates new growth. Pine trees especially could not spread their seeds. The soil would not be regenerated with nutrients from the dead organic material that the fire burns away. And if that material were to remain, it would actually, in fact, build up and choke out life. All of that to say that saving Galactus makes much more sense to me now. But let's get back to the burn run, Steve.
Galactus operates on such a huge scale. I mean, how do you judge someone like that? So all those are fair points. To return to the FF, Sue Richards steadily grows throughout the Byrne run. Up to this point, she had been largely considered the weakest member of the team, but Byrne rightly figured out that Sue honestly should be the strongest just based on what she can actually do. We've seen her deal with a lot of struggles as a wife and a mother. I mean, she loses her second child with Reed in childbirth. Her son, Franklin, has on-again, off-again cosmic powers that she has to struggle to keep in check. She and Reed try to live in a normal life with Franklin, and then they lose all of that due to Puritans who think they're witches. I am not kidding. This happens. Sue suffers a lot in this run, culminating with the Hate Monger arc, where she falls under the mental influence of the Psycho Man. But we're going to cover that story later on when we get to the screen adaptation, so I won't spoil that one for you just yet. By the time that she goes through all of that, though, she comes out of it as the Invisible Woman, discarding the Invisible Girl identity that she started with. Byrne's run was hugely transformative for Sue, and she's pretty much been the emotional core of the Fantastic Four ever since then. So when we talk about strong female characters, this is the textbook example of how to do it well. I'm glossing over a lot with the summary, but Byrne brought a defining voice to the Fantastic Four. He's probably among the best writers with Sue and Dr. Doom especially, but he was pretty good with the others as well. And he also brought in the She-Hulk, who tends to be the most one of the most popular FF members aside from the original four. I highly recommend this run if you're interested in the FF.
Actually, you have me convinced that I need to read that. It sounds amazing. They have his whole run in two omnibuses on Kindle and Comixology, so I will check that out. But I got to ask, are there any other runs I should be checking out too?
Actually, there are some more that I want to bring up, and I'll start up with an underrated favorite of mine. Walt Simonson, who had recently come off his run on the Avengers, came in to write and draw the Fantastic Four in the 90s. What came after that is one of my favorite runs on the book. Simonson came in during the Acts of Vengeance crossover, which pretty much was a fun exercise in throwing every random villain at the FF that he could. But after that was over, Simonson produced his huge cosmic time travel epic, which became known as the Black Celestial Saga. To describe the Black Celestial Saga, I have to step back a bit to explain a few things. Walt Simonson had set up a storyline in his Avengers run involving Kang, Nebula, and a time bubble that left a couple of decades of time inaccessible by Time Machine. When Walt Simonson took over the FF, he had the team explore the time bubble and what's inside with help from Iron Man and Thor. He does it in a really stylish way, too, having Reed build a time sled called the Rosebud 2, which is a nod to Citizen Kane. And every issue hits bigger than the last as Simonson explores the nature of the time bubble and introduces the Black Celestial. It turns out that the Black Celestial has somehow managed to increase the hunger of Galactus to the point where he threatens to devour the entire universe. So the FF have to deal with the dangers inside the time bubble, as well as the Black Celestial, Galactus, and the manipulations of Nebula. This story is honestly some of Walt Simonson's all-time best work, and it is well worth tracking down. After that, though, Walt Simonson just has some fun for a little while, indulging in some fun ideas. So you get stories dealing with alternate timelines and the FF dealing with dinosaurs. Simonson has a deep love for dinosaurs, so he just dropped that in and just found a way to make it work. But there's also a story where he took a few issues off from the art and just did something silly. Art Adams ended up drawing that arc. Walt Simonson replaced the entire FF for a few issues with four of the most marketable characters at that time. Spider-Man, the Gray Hulk, Dan Ketch version of Ghost Rider, and Wolverine. They were billed as the all-new Fantastic Four. Some people would later think that this was a serious thing, but I have to stress that no. Simonson did the replacement FF as a joke. He was poking fun at the marketing of 90s Marvel. By the end of the arc, the team went back to the original four and Sharon Ventura, the She-Thing, who was dating Ben at the time.
Wow. I actually think I remember seeing a cover for the all-new Fantastic Four, now that I think about it. And while I did not pick it up, it did make me wonder what kind of crazy shit Marvel was doing now. I mean, so I was actually one of those who thought it was a real thing. Honestly, the team seems pretty incompatible to me, though. I mean, especially with the inclusion of Spider-Man on the team and Dan Ketch version of Ghost Rider. The world views of those characters do not mesh at all. And them working together is so ridiculous. Looking back on it, I think I should have known that it was not real. As far as the marketing idea goes, I have to imagine that a lot of folks had to pick up that first issue just to find out what the fuck was going on and how long it was going to last. I think it would be like watching a horrible train wreck where you want to look away, but you can't. But actually, knowing that he was poking fun at Marvel kind of makes it cool.
Yeah, this is not a team that realistically would ever last that long. And then they always ended up drifting apart later, as they should. Spider-Man and Logan just never got along that well in general. And then you add in a loose cannon like the Joe Fix-It Hulk and Ghost Rider on top of that. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster. But Simonson knew that. And for an arc, you can make that team work if you give them good enough reasons to play along. I think I mentioned in the episode on Loki that the Time Variance Authority was created by Walt Simonson in Fantastic Four. I just love the idea of the multiverse being organized and managed by clones of former executive editor Mark Gruenwald, who was the continuity guru at Marvel at that time. They start coming into play towards the end of Simonson's run of the book, which coincides with the return of Dr. Doom, and it is a really good Doom story, culminating with a really great fight between Doom and Ben, who briefly turns back into the much stronger Spike Thing. The following issue of that story leads into a battle between Reed and Doom, who are fighting each other using short-range time travel. The whole thing comes to an end when the TVA intervenes, and then the FF spends the last couple of issues dealing with the TVA and trying to get out of there. I adore the Simonson run, and I put it probably on my top five runs of the FF. Simonson injected a lot of fun and passion into the book, just doing things he enjoyed drawing and throwing in some decent comedy along the way. When the book gets serious, though, it goes epic, making some really good use of classic characters. The Black Celestial Saga and the Doom arc are both really great stories, even after all these years.
I just have to ask. Doom had to have got his ass whooped by Thing, right? I mean, even with especially turning into the stronger version of thing, I mean, Doom doesn't stand a chance against Ben. Am I wrong here?
There is a butt kicking that goes on in that issue. Yeah, I mean, eventually Doom does turn things around, but yeah.
Okay, I figured when you said they fought, I was just like, wow, that's a mismatch. But saying that those two story arcs stand the test of time is saying a lot about their quality. I have reread some of the comics I liked back in the day and as an adult, and I find them lacking in some cases because they were products of their time and don't necessarily hold to a timelessly enjoyable comic. We talked a bit about that, how The Dark Knight Returns suffers from this effect. So I might have to see if I can find those runs on Kindle and Comixology. But what do you say we get into Mark Waid's run on the title, Steve?
I'd love to, but first I'll hit you with something that surprised even me when I heard it. Believe it or not, Mark Waid once admitted that he had not been interested in doing the Fantastic Four at first. He was persuaded to do it by FF editor Tom Brevoort, who had invited him on board. But Waid accepted because of Mike Wieringo, who was Waid's old friend and collaborator on their Flash run. I think it was Wieringo's passion for the Fantastic Four that made Waid a fan, in addition to the fact that Waid was a fan of the classic Lee and Kirby stories as well. And a large part of the decision probably was that Waid wanted to work with Wieringo again. A good thing that he did, because this was the last time the two of them worked together. Mike Wieringo sadly passed away a few years after their FF run concluded. Waid's thoughts on the FF are very detailed, and we know much of what he pitched to Tom Brevoort. Much like Grant Morrison did with New X-Men, Mark Waid wrote an entire Fantastic Four manifesto outlining how he saw the characters and what they should be doing. Waid's position on the Fantastic Four was that the characters were great already, that there was nothing wrong with them. But he felt that the previous stories were too reverential to the 1960s, and the series needed to feel new again. That meant that the FF needed to make new discoveries, face new threats. It also meant that showing a new side to the characters that readers had not seen before, and reminding people what had been forgotten about them since the Silver Age. In Waid's view, the FF were not traditional superheroes, but celebrity adventurers, and that was the focus that he took to the series. Waid took on the particular task of trying to make Reed Richards more interesting, since Reed often fell in the role of the stuffy science character who tended to mouth off all the exposition. People tend to forget that Reed was a more action-driven character as a younger man, going on Indiana Jones-style adventures, fighting wars and so on. So Waid decided that he was going to bring that character back, clarify his motivations, and make him a more multifaceted character. And to be fair, I think it worked. For me, Wade's Reed is probably the best version of the character since Stan and Jack at the least. Wow. Waid and Wieringo's first issue set the tone for the Fantastic Four perfectly. It's a simple, self-contained, and single-issue story about a media consultant who hangs around with the FF for a day as he tries to figure out how to sell them to the public. The media consultant is the reader's eye view of the FF, as he sees the crazy world they live in, the family dynamics, and what they do. It's a mission statement on the book as much as it's an issue that tries to change the perception of what the FF is. But my favorite bit comes at the end, where Reed drops the act around his newborn baby Valeria, and then he explains to her where the idea of the FF really came from. Out of guilt for taking away the team's normal lives and not wanting them to be treated as freaks, Reed made them all into celebrities. The whole name Mr. Fantastic and the FF name was meant as a marketing gimmick, not as a statement of ego. To this day, Reed still blames himself for the accident that changed them. It's a really touching scene that adds new layers to who Reed Richards is. And best off, when the comic came out, it was 10 cents. This was a way of encouraging people to buy the book and hope that they stay off for more. I wish Marvel would do this kind of thing more often.
Oh, yeah. They actually did a play on that issue, I think, in the World's Greatest Superheroes version of Fantastic Four, the animated series. We're actually going to cover that next week, but I think that's interesting. I have to say that from my novice perspective, I never really pictured Reed or the FF as celebrity adventurers. I always thought Reed in particular as kind of a functioning mad scientist who really just kind of stumbled upon adventures because of his experiments. Not that I think Reed is mad, but I mean that with the idea that Reed is out there on the fringes of science, where a lot of what he does might be considered radical or maybe even a little mad, if you'll follow me. I will admit that I also thought that Reed was a bit egotistical with the name Mr. Fantastic, but I do know a bit about the guilt Richards carries about what happened to his family and friend, especially Ben. So I like that particular marketing and celebrity spin Reed did with the FF. I also like the idea of an Indiana Jones type figure with Reed, armed not with a pistol whip and knowledge of archaeology and history, but with superpowers and science. While I like the bookworm science guy, I think that an adventurer and explorer of knowledge makes a much more interesting comic book character. I think maybe I might need to see this version of Reed and check it out for myself.
It's definitely worth checking out, but I can see where you're coming from. Reed definitely has that mad science vibe to him, though he restrains it with that sense of responsibility and scientific ethics. I just love the idea that Reed has this wilder streak in this youth, and then he gradually settled down and became a family man. It gives him some depth and a real arc. Wade continued with some smaller stories, though, as he set up his big epic. The second issue dealt with the revelation that many of the Yancey Street Gang care packages sent to Ben Grimm were in fact practical jokes sent by Johnny. Sue realizes Johnny's guilt after Ben starts storming off trying to find out who sent the package. This leads Johnny to fix the mess he caused, and it's a fun issue. After that, the FF have to find a sentient equation, followed by a short arc where Sue entrusts Johnny with the team's finances in an attempt at a tough plug by making him grow up. They're not the most memorable stories of the run, but they're all enjoyable, and they do live up to Wade's mission statement. Now, where the book really starts to get interesting is with the return of Victor Von Doom in a story called Unthinkable. Now, I'll be the first to admit that while he's one of my favorite writers on Big Two characters, I just don't like Mark Waid's take on Doom. I just don't think it gels very well with Goodwin, Byrne, Roger Stern, and others who have played up Doom's sense of honor. Waid's view was that Doom was more like cross-gen founder Mark Alessi, who had Waid had problems with back when he worked on titles like Ruse. And Wade had just come off of out of cross-gen when he came back to Marvel. As Wade saw it, Doom just pretended to have honor, but the only thing he cared about was destroying Reed. He also saw Doom as someone who acted arrogantly, but it was driven by a deeper insecurity, a trait that Wade had borrowed from Alessi. Now, it is an interesting take on Doom, but I just think it runs counter to decades of stories written by previous writers, especially when Doom does things like sacrifice the great love of his life to demons and wear her dead skin as a suit of magic armor. I'll also add that the demons he sacrificed Valeria to were servants of Mephisto, who Doom despises. Mephisto trapped the soul of Doom's mother for years before he finally freed her at a heavy cost. So there's a lot here that doesn't really make sense. I think Wade wanted to subvert Doom, much as he had with the FF in general, and I can respect that, but I still strongly disagree with his approach on this one. Now, to be fair, I still like Unthinkable as a story, despite my problems with Doom himself. I think that exploring the idea of what happens when Doom finally takes the brakes off and starts throwing magic at the FF is interesting. Many of the things Doom does to the FF are extremely clever, and they are often scary. Even Ben gets in over his head as Doom sends a group of mindless ones from the dark dimension to beat him into the ground. It was a shocking moment. But I think the reason I really love this story, despite my issues with Doom, is that it's a great Reed story. This is a story about Reed having to confront his fear and discomfort when it comes to magic and having to beat his greatest enemy on terms that he's not familiar with. Reed is unparalleled when it comes to science, but he's a rank amateur when dealing with magic. So that's a great situation for Reed to have to overcome, especially with his family at risk. But magic has its price, and the end of Unthinkable leaves its mark on Reed for a while. So for me, Unthinkable is a great Reed story, but a terrible Doom story, if that makes sense at all.
Actually, from what you're saying there, it sounds like a lot of my previous perception of Doom might have even come from that. So I mean, that
makes sense.
So that does make sense. I will go more into my thoughts on Reed and magic when we talk about the World's Greatest Heroes animated series. But I really like knowing that show was based in the comics. But let's get back into Wade's run.
Yeah, and I will say it does seem like World's Greatest Heroes took quite a bit from Wade. But let's go now. So anyway, that sounds good to me. Following some more amazing work that he did on Unthinkable, Mike Waringo took a few issues off to be replaced by Howard Porter. Porter did good work. He's had solid runs on JLA and Flash as well. But Wade didn't let up, dealing with the aftermath of Unthinkable in a story called Authoritative Action. The way that he did this was different and quite interesting. With Doom presumed dead, the Fantastic Four go into Latveria and try to clean out Doom's influence from the country. This actually doesn't work as planned, as the FF make enemies for, both within Latveria and from the world powers who are trying to take advantage of Doom's absence. Finally, it turns out that Doom is as really gone as everyone supposed, and he ends up pulling another one of his old tricks, the Ovoid Mind Transfer. Doom learned how to swap minds with other people from an alien race called the Ovoids, which is a trick that Doom has used to cheat death from time to time. This time, Doom uses the Ovoid Mind Swap to enter the bodies of the FF. The team manages to stop Doom again. Again, battle comes at a cost again, this time with the death of Ben Grimm. But around this time, there was a behind-the-scenes complication. Bill Gemmis, who was then the publisher of Marvel, had actually fired Wade and Wieringo briefly in the middle of their run. Typically, when Gemmis got involved in the writing of the book, it turned out to be terrible. He was a businessman and he was not a writer. His own vanity project called Marville was notoriously derided as just one notable example. What Gemmis wanted to do on the FF was a Richest to Rad story where the FF lose everything and have to operate with nothing. I mean, this was a terrible idea, and didn't make a whole lot of sense for the book. After all, Reed could get all his money back in 5 minutes by selling a few patents. Wade and Brevoort tried to come up with a compromise solution that made sense to them, but Gemmis was not having any of it. So he fired Wade and Wieringo and hired a different team to replace them. When fans found out, there was a massive outrage against the firing because the book was hugely popular at the time. Gemmis' decision was so hated, in fact, that it led to Bill Gemmis getting ousted as publisher of Marvel. Gemmis' replacement team were given a book called Marvel's Knights 4, and they were allowed to continue their story. And then Wade and Wieringo were immediately rehired back on the FF. The drama didn't even disrupt the flow of FF's release, and you wouldn't even guess that any of that was going on just by going by the books that were published.
I got to ask a question here, because you had me with a mouth-dropping moment there when you said that Ben Grimm died.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that without spoiling anything, or is it like a big reveal in the story?
There's a little bit of both, but I can say that a lot of it was that Doom in the last issue was mind swapping between the different members of the FF. So basically they were hurting each other, trying to stop Doom. I think that Ben made a sacrifice play, basically killing himself to try to get rid of Doom. If I remember right, it was something along those lines.
That totally sounds like Ben. So that makes sense. I'm a little shocked about the whole firing and rehiring thing. I mean, so all that happened and Wade and Wieringo were able to write and draw the script. It was able to be lettered, edited, and printed all within a month without disrupting the regular release of the title. I mean, damn, that was one fast moving month of chaos.
I'm pretty sure Wade and Wieringo were a decent ways ahead of schedule, which I think helped a lot. But that drama was insane, and it must have been rough on them. I mean, it's not often that you get a rehiring after a public firing of a team off a book. The only other time I can think of where that happened was Gail Simone on Batgirl. And you certainly don't see a case where a controversy like this gets a publisher fired. But in fairness, a lot of people had already lost their patience with Gemmis' antics by that point. They had been going on for a while. And I think the FF firing was the straw that broke the camel's back. But let's move on to what happened after Wade and Wieringo came back. When Wade and Wieringo came back, they followed up on authoritative action in the death of Ben. This was all a setup to lead into a story called Hereafter, where the FF go to explore heaven in search of Ben's soul. Reed had remembered the device that had destroyed Doom's face, which Doom had used to try to contact the Netherworld to free his mother. Reed had found a way to make the device work, and he took Sue and Johnny to go after Ben. It's a fairly bizarre story, with the FF meeting angels and dealing with some heavy metaphysical concepts. It also deals with how the Four deals with issues of faith. Sue, for instance, is a believer and the most resistant to the entire idea of tampering with the natural order of things. Johnny is driven by guilt and a deep need to get his friend back. And Reed is looking at it as a new voyage of discovery, thinking as a scientist. There are some pretty good moments with those very different viewpoints. By the end of the story, the Fantastic Four literally meet their maker, who they initially think is God. In fact, God in the Marvel Universe turns out to be Jack Kirby. The entire issue is Wade and Wieringo's love letter to Kirby. As Kirby states in his meeting with the Four, "That's what my creations do. They find the humanity in God." That's a line that stuck with me, and I still occasionally pull it out. It's a very meta issue that leans against the fourth wall, becoming a commentary on creativity and on faith. Before I talk about the last couple of arcs, though, did you have any thoughts on Hereafter, Mike?
Well, I do, but first I gotta say you do a pretty good Jack Kirby impression. I know a little bit about this from watching like videos on YouTube and stuff, but I am always a fan of exploring metaphysics and faith, especially from the perspective of someone like Reed Richards, whose religion is science. I particularly like a story when someone like that is confronted with undeniable proof of the supernatural and they have to struggle to accept it. Seeing Reed Richards go through that sounds like a lot of fun. Also, I absolutely love that Jack Kirby is the god of the Marvel Universe. That is just badass. As valuable as a writer is to a comic, it is the artist who brings the words to life on the page. Any comic book writer getting the art back from their artist for the first time can attest to this fact. It just had to be Kirby, and I'm a bigger fan of Wade and Waringo for making it that way.
Well said, and I definitely agree with all that. I think Reed accepts the existence of beings like gods, but he sees them in scientific terms. Like there's sufficiently advanced science being indistinguishable from magic. He'd have to look at it that way, because otherwise he's denying the evidence of everything that he's experienced in his career as an adventurer. I mean, he knows Thor. He has his number.
Yeah. When you got a Norse god on speed dial, I mean, you got to accept certain things. It's actually fun to think about how advances in technology and science can appear magical. Like, on this side of it, I definitely want to call it magic. I mean, it reminds me of Who Watches the Watchers episode from Star Trek The Next Generation Season 3, where Picard brought the Manteken aboard the Enterprise and used the analogy of cavemen from her race looking at what the Mantekans can do now and being frightened by it. It would be really cool to listen to Reed give a similar speech like that in regard to how he sees this stuff scientifically, because it certainly seems plausible. But let's finish up this Wade and Waringo section, Steve.
I'm down for that. Since we've already gone fairly long on Wade and Waringo, I'll just breeze quickly through the last three stories. There's a fun little team-up story between Spider-Man and the Human Torch. That story sets up the next arc, which is the return of the Wizard and the Frightful Four. It's a decent attempt to reinvigorate the Frightful Four, trying to paint the villain group as a dysfunctional family led by the Wizard. I don't think the story quite worked because the Frightful Four's dynamic doesn't quite work the same way as the FF's, but I think it's a clever concept, and I like the way the Wizard is used here. It's worth reading at least once, even though Waringo uses it as a break to prepare for the last big arc. The last arc of Wade and Waringo on the Fantastic Four is a cosmic storyline called Rising Storm. It's been a long time since I've read this one, admittedly, but it's mainly a story about putting the shoe on the other foot. So you get weird things like the Torch briefly becoming a herald of Galactus, the FF's powers being switched around with each other, and Reed and Galactus switching roles. Galactus briefly becomes Galan of Ta again, finally getting a glimpse of the human perspective for the first time in eons. It gets a bit goofy at times, and it never hits the heights of Unthinkable or Hereafter, but it's fun. And a Galactus story is a good place to put an end to their run.
So you mentioned something about Galactus there that I don't think I know about. Galan of Ta, was he like a humanoid or something at some point before?
Yep, he was. In fact, the thing with Galan or Galactus is that he was the last survivor of the previous universe. So he survived the crunch of the last universe, the Big Bang of our universe, and he ended up being a cosmic being when he emerged. So that is when he transcended.
Oh, wow. that's kind of cool. I must admit to being curious about the Human Torch heralding for Galactus and to Galactus getting the shoe on the other foot. But, I mean, honestly, neither of them seem like deep wells to me. I mean, did Galactus actually change after that perspective? No, he didn't.
I mean, he did for a little while, and then he went back to being Galactus.
That's about what I figured. The FF switching powers is something that comes up in a couple of the Fantastic Four TV series and even an FF movie. So again, I like that these things are rooted in comics. Honestly, though, it seems like the FF are irrevocably tied to Galactus. He seems to come back into their lives again and again, like Dr. Doom. I was not aware that he was such a regular issue for them, but I do like that. The FF should really be on the front line of more cosmic issues in the films like they are in the comics. They were desperately missing from the Infinity Saga, and I'm really looking forward to seeing them in their proper place in the MCU with them joining the ranks. But here I am talking about the movies and TV, and we're still talking about the comics. I didn't mean to take us on a sidetrack there. Let's talk about the last run you wanted to discuss, Steve.
Sure, I'd be glad to. So the last major writer I want to discuss is Jonathan Hickman. There were a few writers that came after Waite, and some of them weren't too bad, but it took Hickman to get a really strong interest in the FF again. Now, as I've said on other episodes where we've discussed his work, I honestly can't call myself much of a Hickman fan personally. He's a good idea-driven writer, but I just find that his work generally leaves me cold. It's just not for me. But I can't deny that this run left a huge impact on fans. And you'll usually find the Hickman run listed somewhere in any list of any great FF runs. I'll also admit that the Fantastic Four suited Hickman better than a lot of the other books that he's done over the years. So as I see it, Hickman deserves mention because of the concepts that he added to the mythos and the way that he developed the FF as a family. One of the early ideas that Hickman brings in is the Council of Reeds, a group of Reeds from across the multiverse that come together to solve problems. Reed's motto around this time is solve everything, and he starts to think that it's his job to fix every major problem in the world. This does eventually get Reed into trouble, especially when not all the Reeds share his priorities.
I have to say that a council of anybody from different multiverses sounds like a nightmare. I can't even imagine arguing with so many versions of myself about what to do. But a council of Reeds, where they are all just like super intelligent with IQs off the charts, that sounds frightening. I mean, each one would be convinced that they were the one that was right, and they would all have excellent cases to prove their points. I'd be amazed if anything got done at all. Was that anything like how I'm imagining that, Steve?
Yes, that is exactly the problem. Reed comes at it with high-minded ideals, as he often does, thinking that shared ideals are enough. But although Reed is brilliant when it comes to science, I mean, he just isn't the most self-aware person in the world. That's why he needs Sue, because she's perceptive about the human factor in a way that he just isn't. And some versions of Reed can get pretty ruthless. It's his rigid scientific ethics and his love for his family that holds him back from getting too crazy with his experiments. But what about a Reed that doesn't have the FF to hold him back when he goes too far? Or a Reed that is so certain of his own conclusions that he decides to take steps that the main Reed absolutely wouldn't? While I don't have a clear recollection of exactly how it played out now, I do remember that not all the alternate Reeds were as high-minded as the one that we know. But let's move on. Hickman also deals with a lot of diplomatic issues with the various lost civilizations that the FF has met, including a few that he introduced. They find a colony of lost Atlanteans that Namor doesn't even know exist. And through a series of events, Sue ends up being chosen as their queen. There are also some complicated politics with the Inhumans and the Kree, including an arranged marriage between Johnny's ex-girlfriend, Crystal, and Ronan the Accuser. I'm going to go out on a limb that I guess it didn't end well.
I'm going to guess that didn't end well, too. I have to ask how that went down, actually. I mean, I know that the Kree experimented on them in the past, which is what turned them into Inhumans. But I did not know that the Inhumans or Kree had any social or political connections beyond that. I mean, do the Inhumans answer to the Kree?
Not for centuries. There was a time when the Inhumans did answer to their creators in the distant past, but that changed. The Kree abandoned the Earth in their experiment thousands of years ago, and the Inhumans built their own society after the departure of the Kree. The idea with the Crystal-Ronan marriage was to unite the Kree and the Inhumans. Crystal went along with it for purposes of statecraft, but eventually the relationship did improve between them, surprisingly. They were later declared separated by Black Bolt because of things that happened afterwards politically, but there was a time when it seemed like it might have worked if not for politics getting in the way. But let's move on to some other points. Now, there are some other ideas, including the creation of the Future Foundation. The Future Foundation is a group of young minds that are tasked with solving problems for humanity's future. This group ends up including people like Franklin and his sister Valeria, as well as Bentley, who is a young clone of the Wizard, and Alex Power of Power Pack, among others. But the most interesting of them was Dragon Man, who Valeria had reprogrammed with advanced intelligence. By this time, Val is a bit older, she has a full vocabulary, and she's revealed to be as smart as her dad. So after this, Dragon Man goes full-on pacifist, starts wearing horn-rimmed glasses, and ends up becoming the caretaker of the Future Foundation kids. I'm not going to lie, the new and improved version of Dragon Man is probably my favorite character out of this entire run. Other things happen as well, as the main Fantastic Four book is rebooted, along with a second book called FF. Johnny is presumed dead at one point. He gets better. He always does. And then the book relaunches with Spider-Man as the Torch's replacement. That actually wasn't a bad idea, given Peter's friendship with Johnny and the fact that Peter is a scientist himself. You also get a lot of weird time travel stuff going on with adult versions of Franklin and Val, Power Pack coming back together, and then fun stories mixed with weird science fiction comics.
I got to say, with two science nerds like Peter Parker and Reed Richards there to talk to each other, that must have drove the thing nuts.
Probably, yeah.
With Franklin, Val, and Alex Power of the Power Pack being involved, I have to ask if the Future Foundation began trying to manipulate the timeline to benefit the future. If that's so, were there conflicts, like where something terrible has to happen in the past or for the future to survive and that kind of thing? Or I mean, am I way off here?
Not quite. No, there is a little bit of that. Franklin and Valeria's future selves go back in time to correct the timeline and save the multiverse. There was a huge battle between the Celestials and the Council of Reeds that was a multiverse-level threat. So Franklin and Valeria go back in time and try to awaken Doom from a coma he was in the hopes that Doom would be able to change their past. Or as Hickman put it, all hope lies in Doom. I don't remember the storyline that well, but it wasn't a question of the Future Foundation messing with time in any purposeful way. Awakening Doom, though, had unintended consequences, and that leads into the last major Hickman story we'll be discussing. Technically, the end of Hickman's tenure with the Fantastic Four was the 2015 Secret Wars event, because Reed and Doom were at the center of it. The universe ends, and Doom ends up getting ultimate power again, as Doom declares himself God Doom. God Doom ends up reshaping what little is left of reality, placing himself on the throne, and usurping Reed's family as his own. Which I must say is extremely twisted even for Doom, but I digress. Part of the story is Reed making his way to Battleworld and confronting Doom to reclaim his family. Now, while I think it's generally a decent series, I do have some criticism of Secret Wars. The pacing on the series is just too slow and it goes a bit too long. It takes several issues for things to get set up. I think the mini was even extended by a couple of issues that wasn't planned because Hickman didn't place it quite right. Also, one of the scenes the series is best known for is one of this book's absolute worst moments. There is no way that Thanos would confront God Doom the way that he does with no plan to speak of. He just walks up to Doom, arrogantly makes demands of God Doom, and he thinks he's not going to get obliterated? Really? That's suicidal. And there's no way that the real Thanos would make that mistake. Not in a million years. So a moment that was designed to make Doom look awesome only happens because Thanos is dumbed down beyond belief. I'm all for Doom doing awesome stuff as a fan of the character, but not by making a cosmic level genius like Thanos act like an idiot. It just was not earned in my view, and it makes Doom's victory look hollow in the process. So both of them end up looking bad. Beyond that, Secret Wars is worth checking out if you're curious. There is some great stuff in there, and some of the tie-ins are worth checking out too.
So, I mean, I feel like I've been getting to know Doom a little bit more in this episode, but I have to ask something about Dr. Doom that I can't quite figure out. According to Reed Richards, there is no victory, no amount of power that will ever be enough for Doom. What I don't understand is how a man can be so brilliant and skillful and still only learn selectively from his mistakes. He seems to only consider attaining power, like with the God Doom thing, as if having the power itself is the goal rather than even understanding it properly so that he doesn't mess himself up. He is so egotistical that he assumes he is strong enough and smart enough to wield the greatest powers in the multiverse, and time again, he is foiled by his own lack of knowledge. So, I mean, can you perhaps clear that up for me a bit, Steve?
Let me put it to you like this. It's kind of like how some people are great middle managers, but then they start to fumble once they're the ones in the charge of the operation. They have skill set and talents that are good at working at a certain level, and they're ambitious and they want the brass ring. But once they get there, they have to learn a completely different skill set, and maybe they're just not built for it. They don't have the right talent set, or they think that skills that work at one level can work for anything they do because it's always worked out for them. This typically leads to failure. So when you have a guy like Doom, who's been successful at leading a country and has even managed to conquer worlds, he naturally thinks he's qualified to play God, but he really isn't. And we've seen that a number of times when he's had to deal with real cosmic players like Thanos or Adam Warlock. Doom typically gets outclassed whenever he deals with people like that. Doom is that one human who comes close to playing on that level, but he's just a step short of being able to manage that kind of power. That doesn't mean that Doom isn't awesome at what he does. But he's blinded by his ambition and his arrogance, and he just can't bring himself to admit that he can't play in that league. Victor is one of those people who always has to be right, and he can never admit that he's wrong about anything. That prevents him from learning the lessons that he needs to improve.
Man. So, I mean, if I'm understanding you correctly, Doom's nemesis is not Richards at all. It's himself, even in the comics. But despite his intelligence and skill, he will never, ever be able to see that. I'm going to have to put some real thought into that as I read the Book of Doom omnibus, because that is a perspective I thought really only applied to the animated versions of the character. I guess I have a lot of layers to consider here.
That sounds right. I mean, he has a lot of layers. I mean, Victor Von Doom is a tremendously complex and fascinating character, and that's why he's my favorite villain. He has many qualities that are admirable and even occasionally border on the heroic. The man's not a traditional villain. He's a king, and conducts himself with the dignity and courtesy of a king. He's a man of culture and sophistication. He's a self-made monarch, having built an empire with nothing but his own genius. But he's also cold, arrogant, manipulative, and vengeful to a ludicrous degree. There's a greatness about Victor that is held back only by his deep character flaws, and that's why I find something compelling about him. Doom is a character who works for many different kinds of stories as an ally or an adversary, and he plays well against just about any hero you can name. For me, Doom is the gold standard of villains, and there are a few that even come close. But with all that said, I'll offer some closing thoughts on Jonathan Hickman. All in all, I can understand why Hickman's FF has the reputation it does, even if it's not a personal favorite of mine. I don't think it's a bad run by any stretch. It just doesn't push my personal buttons as much as a run like Waid or Simonson's did. But as Hickman's work goes, it's probably among the best of his that I've read so far. He introduced some really neat ideas to the franchise, and he made Dragon Man cool, so he definitely gets points for that.
Wow. I mean, I don't know about you listeners, but I personally had not considered getting into the Fantastic Four comics. They have such a long history, 62 years, in fact, that I found it intimidating, if I'm honest. I mean, where do I start? It was a big question for me. But talking to my friend Steve here, who is obviously a mega FF fan, I feel like I have a bit more footing when it comes to the comics. I know where to get started because of Steve's breakdown. I'm walking away from this a bigger FF fan than when I came into it, and I just want to say thank you for breaking all that down for us, Steve.
Yeah, more than glad to.
But that about wraps up part one of our Fantastic Four discussion. Is now I have to go get myself some Fantastic Four comics. So we'll see you next week and talk about the TV shows and films of the FF. And until then, I want to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.